La deuxième intervention de ce matin, c'est de M. John Paul Gobriel, qui est donc professeur à Oxford. Il est professeur associé à Oxford et à Balliol College. Il a travaillé notamment sur un premier projet qui est sorti comme livre, qui s'appelle « The Whisper of Cities », sorti chez Oxford University Press en 2013. Il est aussi l'auteur de cet article qu'on vient de citer à quelques reprises, qui fait partie d'un ensemble. Il y a aussi un autre article dans le Journal of Turkish Studies portant sur ce personnage à la fois connu et toujours méconnu, qui s'appelle Ilyas al-Mosuli, ou Ilyas of Babylon, personnage très intéressant de la fin du XVIIe siècle, qui a fait tout un trajet à partir du Moyen-Orient jusqu'en Amérique espagnole. Et M. Gobriel, que je connais depuis le temps qu'il a été en thèse à Princeton avec Anthony Grafton dans le temps, va nous parler donc aujourd'hui sur « When Diplomacy Lies Beneath, of Kings and Patriarchs in the 17th Century ». Il me dit qu'il va présenter en anglais, mais pour les questions et les réponses, il est prêt à faire ça en français si on en a besoin.
Ok, merci à professeur Subramaniam pour l'invitation de venir ici, qui m'a donné l'opportunité de retourner à une source qui j'ai lue il y a longtemps, mais de le faire dans une perspective différente, avec notre sujet sur l'histoire de diplomatie et l'histoire connectée de la diplomatie. C'est un grand plaisir, spécialement parce que moi, j'ai de bons souvenirs d'être ici au Collège de France quand le professeur Gilles Weinstein a fait ses lectures il y a plusieurs années sur l'histoire de la diplomatie ottomane. Donc, chaque fois que je viens ici au Collège de France, c'est sur la diplomatie. Enfin, comme le professeur Subramaniam m'a dit, moi j'ai préparé mes idées en anglais et j'ai la tentation de les faire traduire sur le point, mais je ne voulais pas mélanger les idées, les choses en traversant la Manche. Donc je continue en anglais, mais s'il y a quelque chose qui n'est pas clair, on peut le discuter. Alors, il y a des sources qui exigent de l'historien l'usage de l'approche de l'histoire connectée, et moi je vais parler aujourd'hui d'une source comme ça. So let me begin therefore with the treaties preserved today among the collection of Arabic manuscripts in the Bibliothèque Nationale, a refutation of Calvinism written in Damascus in 1671. Now the author of this treatise was Makarios el-Zayim, the Orthodox Rum Patriarch of Antioch from 1647 until 1672. And the work consists of an attack, quote, against the heretics currently present in the land of the Gauls, that is France, and other lands of the Franks who are known as the Calvinists. In a series of 19 questions and answers, Makarios critiques specific elements of Calvinist doctrine and practice. The work is signed by Makarios and 9 other bishops and priests loyal to him. Now, when one encounters a source like this, right away you're faced with several questions. In the first place, why was a refutation of Calvinism even written in Arabic in Damascus in this period? Why should a leader of the Arab Orthodox Church even care about the presence of heretics in distant France? Now, surprisingly, perhaps, Makarios was not, in fact, the only Eastern patriarch to turn his attention to the Calvinists in this way. A year later, in 1672, the patriarch of the Coptic Church in Egypt, Matthew IV, wrote a short work of his own about the Calvinists, and it recalls similar, he has similar details and opinions about the Calvinists. In both cases, the patriarchs appear to have been responding to an invitation to write about the Calvinists that had been made to them by French diplomatic and consular officials. Now, for Makarios, this was part of a much longer history of exchanges with the Catholic Church that went back over 20 years. For it was in 1653 that Makarios had written the first of 2 letters to Louis XIV, both of which described the impoverished status of Christians living under Ottoman rule. In this context, Makarios' authorship of an anti-Calvinist polemic in 1671 was seen by some contemporaries in France as a sure sign of the patriarch's interest in conversion to Catholicism. What they could not know in Paris, however, was that throughout these exchanges with Louis XIV, Macarius had also been in close contact with the Tsar of Russia, Alexei Mikhailovich. Indeed, only a few years after becoming patriarch, Macarius embarked on a long voyage across Central Europe, meeting along the way with local princes in the Ottoman vassal states of Moldavia and Wallachia, which we've heard a bit about just now, before he finally arrived in Moscow, where he spent some 16 months. The entire journey from Damascus to Moscow and back lasted some 7 years. Donc il a passé 7 années en voyageant sous Pétrarque. Mais c'est pas normal, c'est intéressant. Only a few years later, Macarius encore would make a second journey to Russia, this time for a period of 4 years, lasting from 1666. He finally returned to Damascus for good in 1671, and he died shortly afterwards, fatigué, bien sûr, in 1672. Now, traditionally, Macarius and his exchanges with the most powerful Catholic and Orthodox monarchs of his time have been a subject of study mainly by religious and ecclesiastical historians. Such scholars have attempted to divine whether Macarius's letters and writings reflected his growing interests in union with the Catholic Church, or rather his continued allegiances with the Orthodox world. Now, instead, what I want to do today for our purposes in the workshop is to explore these exchanges not as a part of religious history, but rather through the prism of diplomatic history. Now, through a connected history of Antioch, Moscow, and Paris, it becomes possible to recover in these exchanges a set of political actions whereby the Patriarch of Antioch sought to create alliances with some of the most powerful rulers of his time. We can discuss later what the purposes of these alliances might have been. But ce qui compte, c'est que je voulais regarder le Patriarch pas comme un chef religieux, mais comme un chef politique. This is the transformation today. First, a word about the source, et moi je dois dire qu'il y a ici avec nous aujourd'hui des grands spécialistes sur l'histoire de Chrétien d'Orient et sur leurs relations avec la Russie, donc ils connaissent le source mieux que moi, mais je vais lire le source dans une façon différente. The source itself survives in a handful of manuscripts today. It survives in London, Paris, and Moscow, and others, I think someone can correct me on this. The work was written by Macarius' son, Paul of Aleppo. So the account of the text was written by Macarius' son, who had traveled with his father and was asked to keep an account of his travels by a friend. From several clues in the text, it seems likely that Paul carried a notebook with him during his travels, which might have looked something like this. Ça, c'est pas le cahier qui était dans la possession de Paul, le fils du patriarche, mais on peut imaginer quelque chose comme ça. C'est le journal qui est porté par un autre prêtre irakien qui était à Rome pendant 30 années. So a similar notebook was the basis for a revised work that Paul finally completed after his return to Damascus in 1665. Paul's account is especially important for our purposes today for two reasons. First, he provides a comprehensive and detailed account of Macarius's experiences during his visits to a string of lesser and greater courts in Central Europe and Russia. And secondly, and I think this is the most interesting, Paul's training as a priest gave him an eye for particular details of ritual, ceremony, and formalities. This makes him an ideal observer of ecclesiastical affairs, which is how he's normally used, as much as it does an observer of the mechanics of politics. So we have to imagine someone qui est accoutumé à la cérémonie, à les petits détails, d'une façon micro-historienne, if you like. I mean, he's acting in a similar way, reading details in a significant way, who turns his eyes towards politics. And this is very useful for the historian. Now, there have been recent attempts to imagine the papacy in Rome as a sort of dynasty. And similarly, in the first pages of Paul's work, he describes the history of the Patriarchate of Antioch almost as a sort of dynastic history. This is a world where time is divided not only according to the reign of monarchs and sultans, but also by patriarchs. Now, by Macarius's time, the patriarchal household itself was no longer based in Antioch. Rather, you could find it in Damascus. That's where it was based, in Damascus in this period. Now, in trying to understand the reason for this migration, Paul offered a history of the Patriarchate from its establishment in the 13th century until the point of his father's election. Donc ça, c'est la façon dans laquelle il commence ce récit de voyage. Upon his election, Paul writes, Macarius found that his fate would be linked in important ways to the Christian monarchs of his time, and the reason for this lay in the enormous debt that Macarius had inherited from his predecessor. C'est intéressant de se demander où réside ce dette. It's a constant theme in these writings, the debt that a patriarch experiences upon being elected. I think it's interesting in a socioeconomic context to think about what does this mean? Where does this debt reside? Is it private? Is it personal? Is it communal? In search of a solution to this debt, Macarius assembled with the notables and priests of the church to discuss the financial situation of the community. Paul's description of his father's emotional state was especially poignant here. Quote, Macarius grew concerned and became exceedingly worried about this terrible misfortune, the debt, and he was anxious, hoping to find rescue from these dire straits. Even so, he could not find any means towards resolving this problem, nor could he find help from anyone or any way out. Nevertheless, Paul notes that the Christians of Damascus advised Macarius that he should travel to the Christian countries, El Beled and Messahin, the Christian countries, where he could secure assistance from God-assisted and triumphant kings, blessed princes and nobles, who were famous for their true devotion and for their sincere faith. Now, when we read such a line, sort of true devotion and sincere faith of a monarch, we might think immediately of Louis XIV, but it's unclear exactly who is being referred to in this invocation by Paul of the kings of Christian countries. It is very likely that Paul was remembering a letter that Macarius had recently received from Vasile Lupu, the prince of Moldavia, who you can see here in mosaic and iconographic representation. Now, Lupu had a reputation in the Orthodox world for his great charity. And as we read Paul's description of Lupu, you could almost imagine Paul's eyes widening, sort of salivating, dripping from his mouth as he details the huge resources of Lupu and how this man could pay off the debts. For example, Paul describes how Lupu had paid off the debts of the Holy Sepulchre, as well as those debts accumulated by the patriarchs of Constantinople and Alexandria. When Macarius had been elected, he had received an invitation from Lupu to come and visit him. And so we learn two important details about this episode. First, the circulation, this mobility, was a voyage born out of real despair. And secondly, this began not as a mission to Russia, although that's mainly how it's known today, but rather as a visit to an Ottoman vassal who commanded close ties to elite networks in the Ottoman capital. Early in Paul's account, we also obtain a very real sense of how the circulation of individuals connected Damascus and Istanbul to sites further afield in Central and Eastern Europe. To give an example, one of the first acts carried out by Macarius after his election to the Patriarchate was the appointment of a priest, one Gabriel of Aleppo, to act as his exarch or his representative to travel with some of Macarius's people to the king of Georgia, Alexander III. This is how I identify him. I'm hoping someone in the audience who's a specialist in Georgian history can tell me that this is or isn't him, because it's either rather difficult there's at least three sort of rulers in this period. And this is who I think it is. Now, these episodic, somewhat spontaneous missions reflected a larger set of ritual and liturgical connections that accumulated around the spiritual leadership of the four patriarchs based in Alexandria, Jerusalem, Constantinople, and Antioch. And later in his life, Macarius himself would spend nearly a year living in Georgia, and his account of contemporary life there remains an important source for Georgian historians. So what I'm suggesting here is if we... Normalement, quand on pensait de l'histoire connectée, on pense immédiatement de l'Europe et l'Empire ottoman. Ce que j'essaie de suggérer ici, c'est que si nous fixons notre regard sur la religion et les échanges religieux, on trouve un monde connecté, a connected world, qui vient de Constantinople jusqu'à Moscou. An orthodox connected world. In a way, ça c'est le monde de Byzance après Byzance, mais c'est une Byzance qui était, on doit admettre, assez arabe que grec. Normalement, on pense de l'antiquité grecque dans cette construction de Byzance après Byzance, mais je voulais emphasiser l'aspect arabe ici. Aussi, peut-être. Aussi. The material and ritual expressions of this connected world are perhaps best captured in Macarius' experiences as he traveled from Damascus to Istanbul. And I don't want to suggest here that the liturgical, these rituals are identical from one place to another, but only that they're commensurable. That as Paul traveled, he could make sense of ritual and liturgical practices and slot them into some sort of cosmology that he could understand. He described, for example, how on the doors of the churches in Istanbul, he saw, quote, red-footed cherubs, des anges, holding a fiery lance, and that similar iconography could be found in Moldavia, Wallachia, and even the lands of the Cossacks. More interesting, perhaps, was the linguistic diversity of this connected world. In this lovely passage, where Paul describes how in Istanbul the Gospels were read in Persian, Turkish, Arabic, and Greek. And if that doesn't get us excited, he then says, just as we do in Damascus, which makes you pause for a second. And yet perhaps the clearest sign of the simultaneity of Arab, Central European, and Russian space occurred in the most private context of a mass or a liturgy attended by Maccadius. During this liturgy, Paul described how the Patriarch of Constantinople commemorated first Alexis, Emperor of Moscow, and the Russian Empress Maria, second, Vasile Lupu, the Prince of Moldavia, and his wife Catherine, third, Matthew, the Prince of Wallachia, who at the time is enemies with Lupu, we should point out, and his wife, and then finally the Patriarchs of Constantinople and Antioch. As each of their names were read, the chanters intoned three times, Kyrieleison, 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 and even in the closed space of a liturgy, therefore, there's good reason to regard such acts as having as much of a political significance as a liturgical one. This is happening, you know, in the heart of Constantinople, in the same period when only a few years later, 1657, Parthenius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, would be executed by the Ottoman state, allegedly under the charge of treason for having corresponded with the Russian Tsar. So put those two things alongside each other. So religion animates and connects Antioch to places further east, therefore, but Paul's account also suggests the critical ways in which politics marked out the frontiers of this connected world. So politics does disrupt this connected world, or it marks certain areas of it in interesting ways. For example, there's an especially interesting moment during Macarius's journey when he feels or seems to feel that he's crossed a threshold between lands ruled by Muslims and lands ruled by Christians. The first sign of this occurs just after they crossed into Moldavia, at which point Paul describes his joy, his relief, at having heard the sound of church bells loudly ringing in the air. Now, he remarks that this is the first time he's ever heard such a thing. Now, in the Ottoman Empire, what he might be referring to here is that in lieu of bells, there are such things used as wooden clappers or other ways of calling to prayer, which are not actual church bells. Now, this is the point here is that we tend to think about some of these dynamics in terms of a minority population living under a sort of majority Islamic rule, but actually, I think it's more effective here to think of a ruling religion and a ruled religion. In which context, what we have with Maccadius, with Paul at least, is his first exposure to a world in which the ruling religion really is Christianity. It's not Islam. Now, it's during this journey to Moldavia that we first witness the extent to which Maccadius' travels would have been experienced by ordinary people, much like the movement of an ambassador. Moi, je voulais pas suggérer que le patriarche est un ambassadeur ici, mais que l'expérience de cette circulation peut être comparé à l'expérience d'un ambassadeur. For example, as Maccadius traveled, he was joined by groups of soldiers and officials that had been sent to him by Vasile Lupu. And as they passed from one place to another, they presented gifts to all ranks of officials, from the highest governors down to lowly secretaries and chancery officials. Paul comments at one point that they wasted money on a few of these people, so he has the sense that why are we giving gifts to the lowliest scribe along the way? And in return for which they were given gifts and they were vested over and over again. In this way, Maccadius and his suite practiced the very same formal functions associated with ambassadors in this period, but they did so on the move and not based in any permanent embassy. Likewise, Maccadius' arrival at Yashi, where Vasile Lupu's court was based, was greeted with the typical ceremonies of diplomacy. Not only was he presented to the voivode in a formal audience, but Paul describes with some wonder how his father and all that accompanied him were provided with a daily allowance proportional to their individual ranks. So they're given a salary immediately upon their arrival. Similarly, the language of precedence is a constant source of fascination for Paul. Again, we must imagine a priest who thinks about the deacon says one part, the priest says the other part, the bishop says the other part. So he's very attuned to these issues of precedence in the court. For example, his account of liturgies and services are full of long, detailed descriptions of precedence. Who spoke first? who walked to the right of whom, who said what, so on and so on. In a liturgical context, as in a diplomatic one, such details were central to issues of rank and status. In terms of the gifts that Macarius carried with him, what is especially striking is how their value appears to be constructed, at least in Paul's account, relative to their religious and devotional functions. And I think there's an interesting comparison to be made between gift-giving in the diplomatic context, on which we do have quite a bit of secondary literature, and gift-giving in this liturgical context, which for the Byzantine period, there's actually quite a bit on this, but for this period, less so. Where expensive fabrics, clocks, and luxury commodities were commonly exchanged in diplomatic milieu in the Ottoman capital, for example, Macarius carried with him items of local significance, for example, soap from Aleppo, salted pistachios. But more importantly, he brought with him religious relics, icons, devotional objects, not to mention liturgical manuscripts and service books. And these texts will take an important role later in this paper when he arrives in Russia. The value of such items lay in their authority as devotional objects, the usage of which was legitimized by no higher authority than the Patriarch of Antioch himself. For princes like Lupu, who are looking for legitimacy in a local context, the presence, as in the gifts themselves, as well as the bodily presence, d'avoir le corps du patriarche ici dans mon cours, that in itself was crucial in establishing their own claims to sovereignty. Now, for his part, Macarius' arrival in Moldavia represented the culmination of his hopes for securing a patron who was able to free him from his debts back home. Indeed, if we look at the language that Paul used to describe Lupu, you could be forgiven for thinking that Lupu was in fact a ruler to rival the great world conquerors of the 16th and 17th centuries. I mean, you read Paul, it's as if he's describing Louis XIV or Charles V or any of your great monarchs of an earlier period. Just to give you a taste, this is how Paul describes him, quoting here. As for Prince Lupu's stateliness, his knowledge, his excellence, his beautiful mind, his study of books, old, new, and Turkish, and I think the Turkish here is saying this is an imperially minded ruler. This is someone who's linked in to the metropole. And as for his conversation, it is impossible for the human mind to encompass them all. Lupu was truly like one of the Byzantine kings of old. Again here, he's saying ancient Christian kings, and there's a question of whether who he's really referring to, but I think that it's the shadow of the Byzantine emperor that looms over Lupu for Paul's account. He has even surpassed them, for his word was mighty around all the world, owing to his great generosity and his good deeds towards patriarchs, clergy, monks, ordinary people, churches, and monasteries. And he goes on in a very long passage to describe that even Ottoman governors and Turks respect him, that he was so famous that the emperors of Moscow felt blessed by his letters. They treated his messenger with all the respect due to him. The king of the Poles, the Cossacks, married his daughters, which is true, while the Tatar Khan respected him even more, as did the emperor of Austria, Hungary, and as far away as Venice. So this is where you get the panegyric, the sort of hyperbole of rulership in Paul's account. And he described the moment that they celebrated Mass in his presence as the most memorable day of our lives. I should point out that this text is revised later. So there are interesting portions at which we should be very critical and wonder, is he writing this in the moment or is he writing this after the fact? And I think this represents something that he's writing as it's taking place. It was during Macarius' stay in Moldavia that we have the first evidence of his growing awareness of opportunities that could be available to him further east in Russia. And Paul mentions one specific encounter that Macarius had in Yashi with a bishop from Georgia who traveled through the city on his way back from Russia. So you have a Georgian bishop coming back from Russia, going through Moldavia, and Macarius meets him. And as Paul described it, the bishop had returned from an incredibly successful alms-collecting mission to Moscow. The Georgian bishop told Macarius that he had presented himself to the Tsar as the bishop of a church that possessed a piece of the tunic of the Virgin Mary. And upon hearing this, the Georgian bishop explained, the Tsar gave the bishop abundant alms in addition to sables and a new set of ecclesiastical vestments. Now, this episode comprises a very, very brief moment in a very long travel account, but it's an important indicator of at least one reason for Macarius' subsequent interest in traveling to Russia. That is the possibility that such a patron as the Russian Tsar could free Macarius of his debt. Now, this was especially important given what Mukadius gradually came to realize about the problems facing Lupu in Moldavia. The worst thing to do in this period is to go ask for money from rulers who are on the way out. That's exactly what he found in 1653. What he couldn't have known was that Lupu was at the time embroiled in a fierce and pervasive conflict with his neighbors, in particular the Hungarian prince of Wallachia, Matthew Basarab. If you look on your right, just to give a sense of the sort of self-fashioning, of what is still essentially an Ottoman vassal. You can look on the right and see Matthew and his wife, which recalls, you know, what we would expect also from Byzantine iconography in an earlier period. And it's difficult to see, but the closed crown on Matthew's head. You have crowns that are open and crowns that are closed, being a direct claim for his own sovereignty. So just interesting to remember. We may think of these places as off the beaten track or away from the main centers of power, but in fact that's not how they're how they're projecting themselves in this period. I won't get into the details of the conflict between Basarab and Lupu, only to say that events culminated soon after Makarios' arrival in the Battle of Finta, 1653, which marked the ultimate defeat and deposition of Lupu. Throughout this conflict, Yashi was at the heart of the battle, and this experience prompts some of the most poignant and moving passages in Paul's account, as we might expect from a group of priests who were unaccustomed to being in a war zone. for example, he writes about how Paul says he's seen such sights during the war that it would turn a child's hair white. And it's quite movingly some of his prose about this 9 months stuck in Yashi and unable to leave. Now, these local conflicts are important for two reasons. First, in each of the changes of regime that took place in Yashi during this period, time and time again, the rival leaders looked to Mukadius as a source of legitimacy. They asked that he celebrate Mass publicly for them, and in return, they reconfirmed his allowance and that of everyone in his company. You could think, of course, they don't use the words, a type of diplomatic immunity. You feel that, at least, in the text. Secondly, it was Lupu's defeat in the Battle of Finta that brought a sudden end to Makarios' hopes for securing financial support from him. This sudden change of circumstances, and remember that memory that he has of the Georgian bishop and how successful he had been in Russia, this is what persuaded Makarios to leave Moldavia in 1653 in October, reluctantly, I would say, and to travel onwards to try his luck with the Russian Tsar. Now, what Paul does not mention in this account, at this point or anywhere, really, he doesn't say anything about his Makarios' relations with the Catholics, is that just as Makarios' hopes in Lupu were crumbling around him, Makarios also started to consider, as he looked towards Russia, whether he might be better off seeking support in the Catholic world. So we have evidence of this in a letter that survives today that was sent by Makarios to Louis XIV on the 19th of November 1653. That's to say, on the road from Moldavia to Russia. It's not clear how the letter got to France. It's here now in the Archives Nationales. Now, the opening phrases of the letter invoke similar hyperbole as that used by Paul in his description of Vasile Lupu. Makarios refers to Louis XIV in the most magnificent terms, comparing him, again, to our ancient Christian kings, Malukna al-Masihin al-Salafin. Again, is he referring here to Louis IX? Is he referring here to Byzantine emperors? Unclear, but still, this idea of some sort of link to the past. In the letter, Makarios describes the hardships that faced Christians in the Ottoman Empire, most notably the debt that they have accumulated as a result of the kharaj, or the poll tax, which was waged on non-Muslim subjects of the Sultan. What Makarios then requests is rather peculiar, and here I think things get strange, and it's worth thinking a little bit about. He asks the King of France to provide him with Khat Sharif, an imperial edict. Now, this is the same language used, for example, to refer to an Ottoman firman, an Ottoman sultanic edict in Arabic. Now, what this means in practice is difficult to say, although it feels almost as if Makarios believed that some expression of sovereignty or protection of the Christians by the French state might be recognized by the Ottomans. But it's a very strange thing, if this really is just a religious leader, to be asking for this sort of official state. Perhaps what is most interesting about the letter is what it suggests about Makarios' motivations for writing to Louis XIV. Now, first, Macarius refers to similar letters that had been sent to the French king by Macarius' predecessors, for example, the previous patriarch of Antioch, Euthymius. These letters had apparently gone unanswered, but more important, I think, is Macarius refers to having met with the French ambassador in Istanbul, Jean de La Haye, during his journey from Istanbul to Moldavia. That is, back in 1652, before he's even arrived in Moldavia, he had had a meeting with the French ambassador in Istanbul, during which, in a sense, he's already beginning this shuttle diplomacy, or this this via double, however you want to think about it, already before he's even set out on his journey. And just as he set out to visit the Tsar, Macarius sends this letter off to France, and this sort of back and forth, as we've heard in the introduction, this sort of back and forth, this buying of masters would characterize the rest of Macarius' life. Now, in this short time, I want to say something about Russia, knowing full well there are people here that know much more about, this is really the sort of in-progress work on Russia, a new side of things to me. Mais c'est toujours la façon dont l'histoire connectée, qui on est pris dans de directions différentes et parfois quite terrifying directions. So l'histoire connectée est une histoire a histoire of discomfort, really, pour les historiens. But I want to draw out a few points about the Russian side here. First, as has been the case in Moldavia, Macarius arrived in Moscow at an acute moment of political conflict that quickly drew him into everyday local affairs. Now, the conflict has sometimes been described as one taking place between the old believers and Nikon, the patriarch of Moscow, who you see here. I don't think Macarius is anywhere in this image, but maybe someone can tell me something different. The affair concerned the question of the place of the Greek tradition in the liturgical and devotional life of Russia, which was played out in a series of fierce debates over such things as the correct method of prayer and the specific rites to use to celebrate the liturgy. So, for example, an image here, a later image, I think it's 19th century, of Nikon overseeing the revision of the service books. Now, for his part, Nikon sought to revise the service books, correcting them according to Greek originals, in order to purge them of what he saw as accretions and corruptions from Russian traditions based in Kiev. Now, I won't get into we know now, actually, that what he was using as the basis for his revisions weren't older Greek originals, but rather Greek texts printed in the early 17th century in Venice. That's less important for our purposes, but still interesting. Now, these reforms are fascinating from a religious and liturgical perspective, especially if one sees them within a wider context of concerns about religious orthodoxy and practice in the early modern world, which is how I think we should see these changes. For our purposes, what is more important is that these debates that appear or appeared to be purely religious or liturgical were in fact part of a much wider political program imagined by Nikon and the Tsar for refashioning Moscow as the Third Rome and refashioning the Tsar himself as the patron of orthodoxy worldwide. Given Russian competition with the Ottomans in this period, which would only increase later, as we've heard, and the Christian subjects of the Sultan, Nikon's attempts to correct Russian Orthodox practice towards conformity with Greek practices must be seen as much more than just a religious program, but also a political one. And, you know, le loup est entré, Macarius arrives just as this is happening. So he walked directly into the situation, armed with all the authority wielded by an Eastern patriarch. He was consulted at length, for example, for advice on several issues at the heart of the reform, whether two or three fingers are used for the sign of the cross, the origin of the names of particular Orthodox saints, and so on, and so on. Indeed, there is some evidence that Macarius' own copy of the Liturgicon may have provided the basis for revisions by Nikon made to the Russian service book. So his own books might be the basis of revisions. Now, Macarius' prominence in such matters eventually became a matter of concern to officials at the Russian court. He was an outsider. Of course they should be concerned. Most notably when Nikon himself replaced his traditional habit for the Greek styles worn by Macarius and his suite. As Paul described it at the court, this is what they were murmuring. See how Nikon has changed the dress of the heads of our clergy here, which they received by inspiration from the Holy Ghost. Does not the earth tremble at the act of Nikon, who, having been hitherto dressed as a Muscovite, has now made himself a Greek? Now, in the opposite direction, Paul's account also suggests the ways in which the model of political power by Nikon, who had a close relationship with the Tsar, Paul comments on this himself, but we know it from other sources, how The person of the Russian patriarch made a real impression on Macarius. One cannot help but wonder, for example, what to make of Paul's long, detailed account of the marvelous new palace built by Nikon in this period, which you can see here. The important point here is that in Moscow, Macarius encountered an altogether different spectrum of possibilities when it came to the potential political power of a religious leader like himself. Again, a world in which the ruling religion is Christianity and what that could mean for a patriarch. It is perhaps for this reason that many parts of Paul's account recall the obsessive focus on ceremony, political culture, and power that one usually finds in the dispatches of diplomats in this period. C'est intéressant ici de comparer le de la perspective de genre, de comparer le texte de Paul au dispatch of relazioni on the sort of typical diplomatic dispatches of the same period, where one finds similar themes. Paul describes in meticulous detail, for example, the civilities carried out for Macarius. And he writes in a line, you could read this in diplomatic dispatches from all over the world in this period, these civilities were unlike those ever practiced or extended to any other Eastern patriarch or bishop. In comparing Macarius' treatment to others, Paul even extends the comparison to the ways in which Macarius was treated vis-à-vis visiting ambassadors to the Russian court. So he is making this connection. C'est pas imposé par nous, mais c'est là dans le source. The Tsar referred to him, to Macarius, for example, several times as my father. Not quite mon cher papa, but my father, which is an honorific, again, suggesting a certain level of parity. And s'il y a quelque chose qui distingue, je crois, le micro-histoire, ça c'est comprendre ce petit détail, ce petit mot, comme une indication de significance. We can debate whether we agree with that or not, but that we can take this my father very seriously if we want to. In granting such status to Macarius, there was a clear sense on Paul's part that this status was attached to Macarius' person and not to the Ottoman lands from which he came. This is more all the more important given the ongoing conflict between the Ottomans and the Russians that would develop later on. Now, it's very interesting distinguishing here between the person of Macarius and where he comes from. Paul describes, for example, that no one was permitted to speak Arabic in the court on account of the fact that Arabic was associated with Islam. Now, fortunately, Macarius had picked up or he had improved his Greek during his voyages, and this is what he used to communicate with interpreters in Moscow. So in spite of his own origins as Patriarch of Antioch, Macarius was held in great esteem and respect. In spite of his own origins in the Ottoman world, as patriarch, he was held in great esteem and respect. And in thinking in terms of jurisdiction, ce qui est intéressant, c'est que d'une façon, le patriarche d'Antioche, il avait une juridiction sur le territoire de la Russie. Il peut célébrer des masses. He could ordain priests. He could perform sacraments. So these are really, we're in the world of competing jurisdictions already, long before the late 18th or the 19th century. This is already an issue on the ground. Macarius's prestige, however, was not enough to give him special access to information, all of which Paul wrote, and you can hear again, as if he's a Venetian in Istanbul complaining, he writes that information is completely controlled by the Russians. I'll quote here. The Russians will tell nothing to a foreigner, whatever, either good or bad, about their own affairs. Even when Macarius asked other priests of the common people, he could not find anything out. All they would answer, Paul wrote, was that we do not know. Even the children were perfectly instructed in the like dissimulation. Now later, Paul writes that they found out that every Muscovite took an oath upon the cross and the gospel on pain of excommunication by the patriarch, that they would not reveal their national affairs to foreigners. And alternatively, if they should gain any intelligence concerning strangers, they were obliged to communicate it to the emperor. Not surprising, perhaps, Paul's account of the Tsar recalls the same hyperbole that we had seen used for both Lupu and Louis XIV. But I want to focus on two important silences in Paul's account that are worth noting. First, it's interesting that Paul has very little to actually say about doctrinal or devotional conformity between Antioch and Moscow in a problematic way, to say, or in a positive way even. It seems to be more a concern for the Russian side than for Paul. He's observing, he's describing, he's detailing, but the idea of the conformity of these two parts of a connected world is less salient, I think, for Paul than it is for the Russian side. When there is explicit discussion of particular confessions, it tends to be about the Franks or the Catholics and their mistreatments of the Orthodox. There's a lovely line, and I tried to fish it out last night, but I couldn't, where he describes to the effect that he says that things are better off where he is, because when he looks at the Catholics and the way that their sort of forced conversions, their forced baptisms, the way the Catholics treat their subjects is worse than what one experiences in the Ottoman context. Secondly, Paul says very little in his account about whether, in fact, Macarius' journey to Russia accomplished anything in terms of its goals of securing funds for relieving the patriarchate from its debt. There is mention, for example, that some of the people traveling with Macarius collected enough alms to clear their debts. He says this. What is more interesting, perhaps, is the reference to the fact that these same people were also permitted to trade in Moscow for luxury goods, including sables and furs, which they took back with them to sell in Istanbul. This is an important reminder, and there's really, I mean, one thing that I've just kept hitting seeing over and over again is how important alms collecting is in this period. And really, there's probably several beautiful histories of connected histories, diplomatic histories, good social histories of alms collecting to be written for this period. But what is interesting here is that we get a sense that alongside the explicit act of alms collecting, collecting alms, there's evidence that these individuals are also engaging in trade, and perhaps this is what Macarius and those with him were really seeking out when they travel further abroad. Not just the alms and the support, but everything that they could bring back with them to sell in Istanbul, certainly, and possibly further south. I think I have about 6 or 7 minutes. Does that sound right? Apart from these references to trade, it is difficult to say whether Macarius was able to secure the funds he needed. What is clear is that by 1657, he and his company were eager to leave Russia. Paul writes they hadn't had a proper bath in 2 years. I mean, again, this, you really get a feel for Paul and his humor at times in the text. Macarius was unable to leave, however, until he had secured permission from the Tsar, another sort of family resemblance with the way diplomats are treated here. Of course, the Tsar was taking advantage of Macarius' presence to continue to further his own political ends. When they finally managed to secure permission to return to Damascus, they left Moscow, only to be asked to come back a few weeks later. They were chased down on the road so that they could provide their advice to ongoing discussions of local affairs related to the rebaptism of the Poles. Macarius says, no, not necessary. The judgment of one of Nikon's rivals and the condemnation of the old believers. Now, as I've suggested above, none of these tasks were purely religious matters. Rather, they were aimed at getting rid of local political opponents of the Tsar and Nikon. Macarius and his suite returned to Damascus, finally arriving in 1659, and his immediate return involved dealing with some of the problems produced by the debt, and interestingly, he leaves a deputy in his place, Sylvester, I think, and you know, like any clever ruler in this period, you want to leave very incompetent deputies behind you. So when he returns, there's a general sorting out of things that one expects upon the return of a ruler. And I mentioned that just to stress how peculiar it is to have a patriarch out of his see in this way. To give a comparison, if we look further east to Mosul, there's around the same time, the patriarch for the Church of the East in Mosul was known, had the reputation of never leaving the patriarchal residence, to the point that the one time he actually left, all the people around of the laity were astounded and thought that he was going off to preach Christianity to the world. So this is very peculiar. Back in Damascus, Macarius sends a second letter to Louis XIV in 1663. This time, he was more forthcoming. Give us money. This is what he's asking for again. He wants actual funds to help free him of the debt. And these connections were fostered by the French consul in Aleppo, François Baron, who has a very interesting history of his own. And when he sent on these letters to correspondents in Paris, played them up as a sure sign of Macarius' interest in converting to Catholicism. And so when the letters were finally received in France, the propagandists heralded them as proof of the pro-Catholic sympathies of Eastern Christians, and in this way, ecclesiastical historians would continue to debate the issue into the 19th and 20th centuries, and I'm suggesting there's more to do with these letters than to think about, you know, the sincerity of a conversion or these sort of cosmic questions, which I'm not sure that we're equipped to answer. As I've tried to suggest, these exchanges tell us more about the alliances imagined by Macarius in his attempt to secure financial support than they do about his doctrinal position in the debates between Catholicism and the Eastern churches. So let me end with an epilogue of sorts. For only months after having written to Louis XIV for the second time, no surprise, Macarius is on the road yet again. This time to the King of Georgia, 1664. From Georgia, he continued onwards to Russia a second time, where he was present for the 1666 Synod of Moscow, during which Patriarch Nikon was actually deposed. And it's interesting to think about on the ground, how did the former agent of the Tsar, Macarius, and the sort of helper, enabler, become the person tasked with helping to depose Nikon? Macarius' son Paul was with him again on this journey, but he doesn't appear to have left a comprehensive record of the travels. If he did, it has been lost. At any rate, this is because on the journey back to Damascus, Paul himself died somewhere near Tiflis in Georgia in January 1669. Macarius would continue back home without his son, and the patriarch himself would die a few months later, just after his arrival in Damascus in 1672. As for this anti-Calvinist refutation that Macarius wrote in 1671, Macarius died before it was ever sent to Louis XIV. Instead, it was sent to France a few years later by Macarius' grandson, Cyril Zaim, along with a confession of faith penned by him in 1674. Cyril would go on to be a patriarch, but this is a story for another day. But he's using here his grandfather's seemingly pro-Catholic treaties to bolster his own claims to playing that role. So let me end, therefore, by teasing out a few general points. What we have here is a patriarch who, curiously, spent over a third of his patriarchate away from his see, maintaining relations with Orthodox sponsors in Russia while flirting secretly with the most Catholic king of France. Now, if these exchanges can be seen as a sort of diplomacy, then it was first and foremost a failed diplomacy that appeared to have accomplished very little. Now, whether Macarius' story deserves to be a subject of interest to diplomatic historians and to us today is another question. In the strict sense of diplomacy, yes, of course, Macarius was not a diplomat. He was not the agent of a greater power, although there may be a case for arguing that Lupu or the Tsar could have seen Macarius as a representative of the more general population of the Christians of the Ottoman Empire. We can discuss that. But that takes us very far indeed from the traditional sense of diplomats, diplomacy, and diplomatic history. Even so, what I've tried to do here is to show how a connected history of Christianity, East and West, local and regional, could help us retrieve something of the political impulses that risk being overlooked as nothing more than a mere religious episode in the dusty annals of ecclesiastical history. And in doing so, I've tried to make three wider points about diplomatic history. First, I want to argue for an expansion of the spaces and practices that make up the study of diplomacy. This is already taking place. We've already seen this, in a sense, in both of the first two papers. In the early modern world, diplomacy proper was not the only context in which international relations were carried out. Rather, the case of Macarius reveals how informal diplomacy could lurk in the background of other activities, alms collecting, liturgical reform, the exchange of religious knowledge. Secondly, Macarius's political activities suggest that we must expand the spectrum of individuals and sources that we use for the study of diplomatic history. This is already happening. People are looking sort of lower and lower, from diplomats down to scribes and officials. I think it does matter if someone is a diplomat or if someone is a secretary. These changes, I think, are important. Even so, I think we should be adding religious leaders to our group of individuals under study. They're tied in, for example, into the worlds of sociability in Constantinople, the exchange of gifts. They're right there alongside the diplomats. Finally, this connected history of Antioch, Moscow, and Paris has attempted to show that diplomatic history may even offer a tool for historians interested in the study of religion in this period. The case of Macarius is an important reminder of an otherwise banal point. So it's not good to end with a banal point, but the one that interests me most, namely that we must take politics more seriously in understanding the formation of religious orthodoxy in the early modern world. Perhaps the most interesting question concerns the genealogy of these practices. Where does Macarius learn to be political? Now, this is actually quite interesting. Now, he has no representatives of his own, unlike the Ottomans in the 18th century, based in Europe. So we can't imagine him being informed of the will of monarchs like Louis XIV or Alexis of Russia in the way that most rulers accessed information through their ambassadors abroad. Instead, I want to suggest that small-scale exchanges that took place with European consuls and diplomats, like François Baron in Aleppo, these were crucial. Eastern patriarchs were incorporated into the world of sociability. that developed around European embassies and consulates. They weren't simply informants who responded to the questions of their interlocutors. Rather, they were able negotiators with their own goals and agendas, and we should recognize them as such. In an age when a patriarch could be executed for corresponding with the enemy, the fact of Makarios' great unceasing efforts, roving around, constantly on the move, reveals something of his conception of himself as both a ruler and a servant to his own people. So connected history reveals in this case, as in so many others, the impossibility of disentangling the religious from the political when it comes to early modern rulers, kings, yes, but also patriarchs. Merci.